Welcome, listeners. Today as a guest, I have Liam Reed. Liam, please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, yeah. So my name's Liam. I am from West Seattle, but I currently live in Bellingham because I'm going to school at a college called Fairhaven, and am currently working on studying transitional justice through abolition and eco-psychology.
Wow, that's very impressive.
Yeah.
So, what is that? So, what kinds of things are you studying and learning?
Well, it was a topic, I guess, inspired from kind of the past 5 years of social work I've been able to do. I, for the past 3 years, have worked with adults transitioning out of homelessness, and 2 years before that, I got to work with youth experiencing homelessness. And so my drive there was to come back to school to kind of rethink our approaches to how we as a society want to solve homelessness. Because unfortunately, I don't see systems that are working. What I do see is kind of these rotating doors of services that keep the homeless population oppressed and neglected and abused and traumatized.
100%. I myself have witnessed the same in my volunteer work. Let's, you know, just to start out, I mean, I really want to get to kind of why we shaped our society and set up our society in the way that we have, right? So I guess my first question would be, what do you see not working?
You know, actually, I love that you want to understand where these viewpoints, I guess, come from, because what kind of helped me see why things aren't working were the roots of the systems that we are currently using for support. So, like, the creation of the prison system, the creation of mental health services, finding out why these things were created actually really helped me comprehend what we're trying to do with the services we currently offer. So, for example, we in society have this idea that people who use drugs are bad. And they deserve to maybe spend time locked away in a prison cell. But when you take a breath and you look at where that mindset comes from, it's not that people who do drugs are bad. It's that Ronald Reagan created a war on drugs, and through this propaganda fairy tale, convinced us as a population that people who use drugs are bad and need to be locked up. So because of policies like the war on drugs, or when, and I'm pretty sure this was the Reagan administration as well, shut down in the mental asylums that we had, and I am at no liberty to speak of whether or not mental asylums were working, but we didn't replace them with anything. They weren't, yeah. Right. But the problem is we didn't replace them with anything. We just kind of left everyone who was there to survive on their own. We end up just creating an entire population of people that are villainized. And I guess,
So that's really great to bring up. So basically, to summarize, you're saying that Reagan, who is a very, you know, conservative in his religious ideologies, used his position of power to basically defund the resources that were originally housing people suffering from mental illness, addiction, things of that nature. Not to say that they were doing it in the best way possible, but at least that there were social services that, if left funded, probably would have evolved to help people.
Yes.
Versus the services that were forced, that they're forced to utilize right now.
Yeah, yes, completely. And unfortunately, that's only one example of what happened. There's been so, like, another one is the Clinton administration.
Yeah, I'm not a
fan. And well, and their whole tough on crime policy that led to
the crime bill.
The All crime right. bill and the largest mass incarceration. I mean, it's absurd, the amount of people we lock up, and it just shows the systems that we've leaned into as well. So there's the Reagan administration with the systems we've disregarded, and then the Clinton administration shows the systems that we've leaned into that have kind of opened up this neoliberalistic landscape of, I don't know, capitalistic like wasteland that we're currently existing in.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, something that I've, like, from my experience working for different nonprofits, I ran one for a brief period of time until I kind of realized how ineffective it was. They're definitely set up more and structured for a for-profit business. You know, yes. where there's like a board of directors that get to dictate how much they get paid. They get to dictate what kind of, you know, like how much of that dollar actually goes to help people, right?
And so how much of that dollar goes to their personal bank account?
Oh my God, yes. Absolutely. And it's not only just, you know, they're not only raising money from big donors by any means, and that is a big part of it, but they're also being heavily funded by our tax dollars, which they are then misusing. Would you say that that's
fair? I'd say that's completely fair. When you look at where nonprofits especially decide to invest their money, it tends to be in people who are great at grant writing or 100%. Human resources employees. Like I've been working on the front line in social services for 5 years now, and at no point have I felt supported in the work we're doing. If anything, it's just an afterthought. The nonprofits currently have in our system are just trying to make themselves look good on paper. They want to be able to go to the government next year and say, look at how many people we're housing, give us more money. And what that opens up is a real neglect for retention of truly trying to house and support someone. It opens up the freedom for them to say, look, we tried. Look, we spent 9 months trying to house this person, but they're so violent. Their behavior is so bad. They won't stop using drugs. And, you know, they're the ones who claimed to be housing first, to have right response and to look at these humans through an empathetic lens, but they're blinded by the propaganda that society's kind of infused with us, and they're just there to, they've fallen into this trap of like, let's make money, let's be a thriving business. It's employee retention, and more importantly, back of house employee retention that they're concerned about. It's not how long can we supportively house this person. And part of it is because they've given up because there's all these other systems that are supposed to be supporting our population, not even just the homeless population, but our population, and they're not. And the homeless population is just experiencing the brunt of that. And what I mean is like hospitals or prisons. Like, these systems are just further traumatizing. They're not actually uplifting and supporting. So
not healing.
Right.
They're coming from a place of shame versus a place of healing, a place of respect, a place of valuing a human life and feeling compassionate for whatever pain they're experiencing, or, you know, neurocircuitry in their brain that is inhibiting them from functioning in society. And I just want to be very, very clear that, you know, the demographic I'm talking about does not fully represent the entire homeless population. Can you touch on a few other demographics, just because I want to make sure that we fully understand what the homeless population, who these people actually are?
A lot of them have just lost their entire support system. One of the things I learned really early on in this field is the only thing separating me from a lot of the kids and adults I've gotten to work with is I've had two parents my entire life. And that's something that weirdly a lot of us take for granted. It's just friends and family. You know, how many of us, if we lost the house we're living in, could go stay with someone else? I think what you're seeing here, you're right, isn't just some dude on the, at our, you know, we see at a red light holding up a sign. It's a whole diverse cast of us, of people who come from every walk of life, and have just been really traumatized and neglected and left to survive on their own. I mean, so many of these people are just in our kind of three states of survival, which is flight, fight, or freeze. And that's just because their human rights are being completely neglected. I mean, they don't have a roof over their head. They don't have a tap to run their water out of. There's no stove to cook food on. And, you know, when I hear some of the stories of what these people have been through, shit, I would be doing copious amounts of meth as well. I would be escaping with heroin if it was something that, that brought about a relief. Yeah, these people absolutely have gone through that I can't even fucking fathom, and yet I'm on this side of society that's like, well, pick yourself up by the fucking bootstraps and go get a job. And I'm just like, that's so easy to say. And there's no empathy there. So, I mean, that's the first step, really, is we got to see that these are our brothers and sisters. These are our friends and our family.
These are people who need the community to step up for them.
A community. See, yes, that's ultimately what I want to do what we need to do is we need to step away from this society, quote unquote, that we've built up and lean into our communities.
Yeah. I mean, 100%.
That's how you don't solve homelessness with housing first. You don't just throw them in a house and say, deal with it. Some of these people have never even been in a house. They've survived on the streets for years. And honestly, it's what they're comfortable with. A house is kind of gross, especially an apartment full of other homeless people. And they don't have any community. So they don't have anyone coming around them to just
rehabilitate.
Yeah, tell them that they're supported community. Love it.
So Yeah, so just for our listeners, I just wanted to, you know, kind of put out there a few important things to consider is that, one, Howard Zinn, if you haven't read his books, he is one of the most brilliant authors I've ever read. I was borderline obsessed with him in college. And here's kind of what's interesting about some of the references he makes in his books regarding homelessness is that for the majority of people who are homeless, they're homeless for, you know, anywhere from 3 to 6 months typically. And that, you know, the bulk of community resources are spent on the chronically homeless, classified as people who are homeless for more than a year. 50% of the existing homeless population live in their cars. They don't live in the street, so you may not see them. There are families. There are people displaced by coronavirus. There are people who broke down mentally due to the pandemic they inflicted. And one of the most, one of the things that really boggles my mind is the chaos surrounding access to basic survival needs, right? So homelessness definitely gets perpetuated by access to aid, right? It shouldn't take, so it takes, you know, my experience interviewing a homeless, a wonderful, amazing woman who's experienced homelessness for 15 years on the streets of Seattle. Her name is Dee Powers. I'll be releasing more information of our interview on YouTube if you want to subscribe, links below. But basically what she says is that it takes her an entire day just to survive, just to go take a shower, to get food, to access internet, to power her RV, to just basic survival needs, to where her energy is focused on that versus finding alternatives, right? You know, go ahead.
I was just, in some cases, it takes a year to even be considered homeless. And that's a year of documented, so like a nonprofit worker or a government employee has to verify that you've been on the street for 12 months before you can be considered you need to live on the street for 12 months in some cities before you can be considered for housing.
Which is ridiculous.
Absolutely absurd. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, what's really, really interesting, you know, I am a proponent of housing first. I've absolutely seen that method work, because I think regardless of whether or not somebody is using drugs, I think regardless of whether, you know, they're experiencing depression or anxiety, PTSD, mental health issues, they are not animals. They deserve a home. And it's actually cheaper, you know, if you take into account how much money we spend on jailing them, imprisoning them, resources, grants, aid, all this. It costs on average in the state of Washington about $50,000 a year for the average homeless person, right? With housing and, you know, support and other supporting resources, with housing, that brings the cost down to about $20,000, you know? so that we could invest and expand our mental health services so that they would have access to things that can help them, right?
Right, and that's, yeah.
Yeah.
Housing First is this really, it's a beautiful concept, but it only works if the systems that are also then supposed to support people are supporting people.
Because I do think there are good people behind the project, and yes. I think that it's a really good attempt in creating these little tiny villages, right? But these tiny villages, these houses, I mean, they show exactly, just from the outside, I mean, it looks like society was like, we don't want to do this, but here's the bare minimum, here you go. You know, they literally live in a shack, like it's like a third world country, when we have thousands upon thousands, I think 1 in 12 properties and units are vacant, right? I think that there's like a big portion of our taxpaying dollars in which the city and the government and the state pay into maintaining these vacant properties.
You give society more than I do. I mean, I don't even think this is our bare minimum attempt to help people. I think this is our bare minimum attempt to not look at homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I guess that's where you're totally right. There's so many really cool Housing First programs and awesome people behind a lot of, especially in Seattle, there's some really cool work.
There is
going on that's putting people in houses. It's just that it's mixed in with a lot of these other nonprofits that are taking advantage of the phrasing Housing First. So they say they're a Housing First organization, and then 9 months after someone's housed, they're kicked out for drug use.
Yeah.
Which isn't Housing First. But that's...
No. It's religious patriarchy first.
And that's why I think the Housing First that is working, you do see those little small community-looking villages popping up, because that's what you're gonna develop. I mean, it's gonna become a small town, and when you have empathy and you're listening to these humans, they'll tell you what they need. They know what they want and what's gonna help them feel just fulfilled as a human. Feel nourished.
Right. I mean,
our concepts of living are all very different.
And here's what I will say about, you know, my experience is that a lot of these people are so underutilized. They are some of the smartest, most brilliant minds I've come across. Like, they know how to pull apart a radio and make an electric bike out of it, you know, something like just something crazy, like MacGyver, you know? And,
I watched a kid shred the piano to some Mozart or Beethoven symphony. And I mean, I can't even play the harmonica.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that is a symptom with being natural, you know, with being gifted or over, you know, having a brain that thinks way too much. I think that there's a reason why they're feeling disconnected from society, because our society is not, there's no connection with control. There's no connection with fear. There's no connection. There's no connection with ultimatums, you know, that ultimatums do not work. Get clean or else you can't live here does not work. It's been proven over and over and over again. Or because telling people that they have to live a certain way or be a certain way, that control, right? We need to take our boots off of their necks.
Yeah.
and come from a healing and loving place, not a shaming or you're a bad person or do this or else you can't coexist in our community.
Yeah, we seem to have this idea that it's the homeless population that needs to quote unquote de-escalate, but we're the ones that need to de-escalate. We are the ones engaging crisis with the solution being to shoot people. Like, we're the ones who are escalated in this state. And it's weird because it's just the socially accepted state of mind. So we think the approach is then homelessness is an issue. Like, we start to think it's something that needs to be solved, but it's
something that needs to be loved.
Yes, because society, I think, is what needs to be solved. Like, we are the problem.
We are
the problem. It's not the homeless population. It's us.
It's like helicopter mom syndrome, you know, like yes. The mom. I don't know that if that's a good example, but that's just kind of what it reminds me of when I see certain nonprofits and their ideologies of how they want to manage the crisis, right? And here's a big thing that I really want to bring to the awareness of Seattle voters specifically. There is a charter amendment on the ballot for it's you know, something I've never seen before, but it's where they're going to dictate policy through a charter amendment and let the city vote on it. And so this is being headed by an organization called Compassion Seattle, and they're very, very well funded by venture capitalists, real estate investment groups, you know, big donors that have no compassion for the homeless on our streets. So my experience with this organization is that they have swept homeless camps. They have destroyed their tents. They have, they have basically destroyed and thrown away their only source of belongings with no place to relocate them or to provide any kind of services to them. And they claim it, you know, as needing to be done. And it's run by a bunch of Karens. I've seen them in city hall meetings, you know, saying that mutual aid is a form of Marxism or anarchy. And it's like, mutual aid is the community at their own discretion wanting to help people. Politics aside, I really, really want everybody to vote against this, like, that actually cover the roots of it. Go to what the ACLU says, make their statement. You know, they claim that they want to build like 1,000 new shelters. Okay, we currently have roughly 10,000, 12,000. I think it's definitely more than that. And they're not really being honest about the current statistics of Seattle. But not only that, there is an eviction moratorium in which, you know, I've heard figures from 44,000 to 68,000 people facing eviction. That's going to double our homeless population. And if this charter amendment gets passed, what that does, it puts into our legislation that we are allowed to remove people from our streets without any recourse. You know, 1,000 homes or 1,000 places of housing is definitely not not going to fix the problem, and it lacks the wisdom in terms of getting to the root and the systemics of why this is even happening in the first place. So that being said, I'm just going to take a quick picture. You know, coronavirus has completely decimated homelessness
very recently.
It's
like shelters.
They were operating at 25% capacity because of coronavirus, right? People who were getting, you know, people who became homeless this last year were far more likely and susceptible to contract coronavirus. And I don't even know how many of them died because of those complications, but
it's only an estimation. Actually, there is a, and that's, this isn't even an estimation of the pandemic's effect on homelessness, but just when dealing with looking at homeless deaths, it's a huge unknown. I actually, according to the National Healthcare, the National Healthcare and Homeless Council, or the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council, it's like a group I was looking at because they're just focused on facts, I guess. But so they were, it's estimated that between 17,500 and 46,500 homeless deaths occurred in 2018. So I think what's jarring about that is just the gap. So it's not that it's known that 10,000 people died on the streets this year. It's estimated that between 17,000 and 46,000, like, it's a pretty big gap in deaths to not know about.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me, you know, let's move on to something a little less, it's a depressing subject matter. But it's one that we need to open our eyes to, and it's one that we do need to actually address. We can't just keep letting people taking advantage with their power. We need to, as a society, stop closing our eyes to the situation, because it's giving people who are ineffective, corrupt, discriminatory power over the situation, and it's slowly shaping our society further away from what I think our community wants.
Yeah.
So,
well, I think it's complicated being a Seattle voter right now, because we live in this bubble where, at least if you've been in Seattle your whole life, you tend to think the world's liberal, or especially Seattle, that it's doing all this good stuff for humanity compared to wherever. But the truth is Seattle's been this like experiment ground for billionaires on how to manipulate policy, and the billionaires won like a while ago. We really need to start looking at what it means to have our voice as a community heard, because I don't think that your average Seattle voter's voice is being reflected in
it's
the
not.
Change that's happening. Yeah.
So
my first kind of glimpse of this was looking at how charter school policy came in Seattle, and especially how much of an impact on homeless youth it's had in creating. And wait, just how many... In an article written by Sally Ho in the Seattle Times, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has given about $25 million to the charter group that is credited with keeping the charter schools open after the state struck down the law and then lobbying legislators to revive the privately run, publicly funded schools. So there's this really interesting history in Seattle where teacher unions and the general public three separate times shot down the legislation for bringing about charter schools in Seattle. And then you see, after the third time, you see Bill Gates kind of step in and donate a shit. Sorry for swearing.
No,
you see
swear.
Bill Gates. Okay, perfect. You see Bill Gates step in and donate a shit ton of money. Like, just to the point where the teacher unions trying to address these policies and educate the population on what these initiatives were going to bring about couldn't even compete because it's apples and potatoes. Like, the billionaires were donating so much money to bring about like commercials and radio airtime and billboards that we ended up with charter schools in Seattle, even though a majority of people didn't want them and still don't want them. And they're currently being totally used and abused by the billionaire class more money because they are this privately funded, or it's privately run, publicly funded.
Where
so
they can,
our money and would have gone towards say the public school systems is now like, split up. Some is given to charter schools that it's really weird because if you look at charter school websites, they boast that they're going to solve racism.
How is charter schools affected the homeless youth specifically?
How do I phrase this? They destroy the school system that was their community and take away, I mean, it's through these really big issues that I'm not the expert on, but things like white flight, things like gentrification, the charter schools just kind of help create these big white bubbles where the white people in society are able to find the education they need and everyone else is left with
scraps.
The scraps. I mean, that's if you look at Rainier Beach and like what they've had to do to just fucking survive and what they did to survive, like this school, they were given no funding from Seattle Public Schools PTA. They raised all this money by themselves, built like an AP or not AP, but a IB program to help really invest in their kids. And after all this work and all this struggle, all that opens up is a ton of white parents deciding they're going to move to Rainier Beach and capitalize on this growing school that no one cared about except for the people living there. And so now you have this community that's been destroyed by the neoliberals in Seattle that don't even realize what they're doing. Just
I don't
like,
think they do.
They're just blind. They're totally blind. And like, how devastating is that too, to be a part of this community and then to have people that say they're a part of this liberal community that want to support people come in and just fucking destroy your everything you've been working towards.
So what do you see working that has been helping people get off the street, recover? And I'm a big proponent of plant medicine. I'm a big proponent. Yeah.
That, I mean, plant medicine is, I guess this eco-psychology is something I'm working to understand, but let's see, someone who's helped kind of form what I know about it, I should rephrase this, an expert in eco-psychology, I think the guy who coined the term, his name's Theodore Roszak, says that eco-psychology suggests that we can read our transactions with the natural environment, the way we use or abuse the planet, as projections of our unconscious needs and desires, in much the same way we can read dreams and hallucinations to learn about our deep motivations, fears, and hatreds. So I guess it's this cool study on basically restoring the earth. I'm coming to understand that eco-psychology is a phenomenal cure or attempt to cure because it centers our focus back on the earth, this thing that we've damaged that we were supposed to take care of and didn't. We can put blame wherever, but ultimately it comes down to, are we going to wake up and take care of it? And a big part of our healing, a big part of healing someone who's experiencing homelessness or someone who's experiencing drug addiction or experiencing mental health issues is restoring them to this mythical, like really unknown entity that is Gaia, like that is Mother Earth. And it's hard for us to do because we committed genocide upon entire groups of people that were rooted in this understanding. And then, we killed off the witches that weren't these green women brewing potions. They were women connected to the earth that understood healing and medicine in a way that we now will probably wrestle to ever understand again.
It's coming back.
That's where our healing comes, I think, is restoring witchcraft. Like, we need witches in the world.
Well, no, I actually am very, they were very much a part of the Black Lives Matter movement, both in Portland and in Seattle. I'm unsure about other locations, but, you know, extremely interesting about the community of, it's literally like moms, it's college kids, it's women who have, you know, natural horticulture abilities, it's people who study metaphysical sciences, you know, people who really understand the concepts of consciousness, concepts of law of attraction, the concepts that, you know, we are an energetic signature that has outputs that can affect other energetic signatures just by being in their presence, right?
And it's, I mean, and it's,
yeah.
Well, everyone, I think, should read The Earth Path by Starhawk. It's been phenomenally helpful in helping me understand kind of what happened, like where we went wrong with our pursuit of witches, who decided, you know, to kill witches, and what witches are today in our society and what they're currently doing.
They're smart women. That's what witches are.
They're working to restore communities.
Yeah.
Which is the focus we need right now. I mean, we need to understand that we're all interconnected. We're a part of this earth. We're a part of each other. We're not these individuals that propagandists helped us think that we are. Like, we need each other.
Yeah, absolutely. So getting back to homelessness, because I really want to get to social justice reform. But homelessness, what do you see working? What are your top three things that you see working?
There are really amazing programs. They deserve, but I want to say they're in like Chicago and Portland. I feel like if you look up like white van programs, you'll get maybe an idea of this. But basically, they are a nonviolent crisis response force. So
yes.
That's one of my favorites right now. I'm in love with it. To any listeners out there, look in your community and see if there are these programs that you can call that are basically, instead of calling 911, call this number. And that's, if I end up working for one of these groups, I'd be in love with my situation. Because I think that's the approach we need here is not... We really don't need people in uniform showing up to just escalate the situation and ultimately just bring someone to the hospital where they get sped out or jail where they sit in a cell for months on end. What we need are empathetic people that are just, they just want to sit down with someone, maybe for the day, maybe for a little bit, like with an understanding of services in the community and where to direct them. So that's right up there, number one for me, is a nonviolent, empathetic crisis response force. The groups that are doing that, killing it. Food restoration, I don't know the right word for this. Food sustainability, food justice. The groups, there are so many really cool groups, especially in Seattle, that are working to bring about a sense of food justice. So one that comes to mind really quickly, I think it's La Roxy Productions, but there's some really cool nonprofits going on in Seattle that are focused on healing through just bringing about food, like traditional foods. Because you look at the food bank and like that's not, some cases that's not food you want to eat. Like I've seen some imitation crab there that was like a year old. Like. Ooh. Yeah. Real
quickly, I wanted to say that a recent study that was done, they linked mental illness to diet specifically, to your gut, to nutrients, getting the right vitamins and minerals could have a huge impact in terms of the neurocircuitry that your brain produces, the connections. And healing.
Yeah. Well. I mean, that's if people want go, you know, the morning and afternoon without eating and then eat dinner and look at how much more capable you are of thinking and feeling and just not being a total jackass to people. Like when we're hungry, we become dicks.
Oh, me too. I get very hangry sometimes.
Yeah. So I guess, yeah. And then the third approach I would see to healing and restoring people comes through that recentering what it means to be connected to nature, trying to wrestle
plant medicine,
but also like plant psychology, I guess. So like, I guess understanding like another source of at least some of our mental health issues, isn't actually like anxiety, it's eco-anxiety and eco-despair, I would say. So like I personally have what I would refer to as end of the world terminology. It's like everything's either the best or the worst, but I think that that's rooted in something very real, because when I look out at the world, like we're destroying it. When I drink my cup of coffee in the morning, like there was a lot of gasoline and damage labor to the earth. Yes. And slavery. Yes. Put into just me getting this cup of coffee. And if I reflect on that too long, like, holy fuck, I start to develop anxiety or all this stuff. And so it's funny that it's maybe funny is the wrong word. We're approaching it wrong by trying to go to, I guess, like I'm not a fan of of just taking a pill to fix it. Like, there are real sources of our anxiety and our despair, and it's not going to come about by just leaning into to this destructive society. It's going to come about by restoring the nature. And so that's, well, I mean, it's one of the ways we solve, we house humans, is to refocus on the earth. Like, how do we live in a community that actually brings about life, instead of living in a society that just fucking pours cement over everything and chokes the air out of the world.
That was very insightful, and I do agree with you. Those are some broader perspectives that could definitely transition and shape our society and lean in to a more loving and healing community environment in which people aren't getting so much anxiety from having to look at all the chaos around us, right? So
yeah,
you've worked with the homeless youth in our jails and prison systems, is that right?
I wouldn't say I've worked with them in the jails and prison systems. I've worked with homeless youth, and the unfortunate side effect of working with homeless youth is that they are constantly in and out of our prison system. So I've gone to visit them quite a few times. I mean, I've seen how they're treated and the kind of quote unquote justice that they're.
Can you go into detail about how they are treated?
I can try. Yeah.
Just like a few things.
Yeah. So one really jarring experience for me was going to advocate for one of the kids I was a case manager for. Mm-hmm. Basically, if I show up to court and tell the judge, "Hey, I'm in charge of so-and-so's housing and supporting them in that housing," the judge is more likely to say, "All right, we'll get him out of here." I think that's disgusting in the first place.
Yeah, but, I agree.
But unfortunately, that was my job, was to just go show up there. And what ended up happening is I got put in a room, and there's a TV, and they're in the jail, like they're in the prison, they're in the jail, and there's a judge there. They get ushered in, like shackled, arms and legs. The judge just kind of really, I mean, this dude doesn't care. Like,
yeah.
He has to work all day in this fluorescent lit room and listen to all this stuff that's probably the same story over and over again in his mind. And so he's just there to get to his lunch break. Like, so the kid I'm there to say, like, please don't lock him up. I'm here to support them. We have a house for him. Like, if you lock him up, he's going to lose the house. The kid I'm there to see gets up. The judge just instantly goes 9 months. I'm screaming at the TV, like looking for the mic button, pressing all this stuff. No one's in the room to help any kind of thing. And so they sent him to Yakima, and I didn't see him for 9 months. And then I guess I can't get too specific because I don't want to give away like details about,
yeah.
That's what's weird right now is I guess there are things that are too, I don't want to identify anyone, but I guess what I continuously see is like, I would go to visit, I'm saying kid, but when I met them, they were under 18. When I was visiting them in the jail system, they were over 18. But they're still like, they're still so young. They've never had guidance. They, you know, got kicked out of school. And unfortunately,
I mean, we put the age of 18 as the age of adulthood due to, you know, the military draft, essentially. But that does not mean that somebody's still not a child or hasn't fully developed their brain and isn't capable of, you know, regeneration, right?
Right. And so it's just so weird to see that our solution for this was to kind of to isolate them in this quote this institution, quote unquote, that is, I mean, it's modern day slavery. And I'd go into these, you know, you get buzzed into these really like dreary freaking hallways, and you got to go through these metal doors, and it's not like a bed, you know, a bed and a bunk bed and like you and one other person. Like I'd see a contrast of different cells. I mean, there's been so many different, you know, prisons and jails built that there'd be one where they're isolated alone. There'd be one where there's 50 people in a little group, just bunk beds everywhere, one toilet, one table that four of them are playing cards at, and everyone else is just kind of scattered amongst the room. And that's, there's no direction given. There's no, like, we're not trying to educate or restore people. So there's all this time being wasted. It's like, how much better could this time be being spent if we were trying to figure out what motivated and inspired these people instead of just making them feel guilty or ashamed or even thinking that they feel that way. Like, maybe they just feel pissed off because maybe they feel like they didn't do something wrong. Right.
As they should.
They have every right to just be infuriated with the way they've been treated.
They're standing up for themselves in the only way that they know how.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that's helped me come to learn the prison system is where it came from. The prison system did not come from this desire to rehabilitate people or restore them to community. It actually came about through a desire to control a population. And a lot of it was inspired by a pandemic that happened way before ours.
Spanish flu?
Yeah, I think so. Michael Foucault, I'm butchering his last name, has this really awesome history of the panopticon. And it's basically just what's become our society's current form of control. And that's what our current prison system is doing. It is controlling people. It is not rehabilitating them. It's not restoring them to their communities. It's control. It's a control mechanism, not just for people in prison, but for the guards working at the prison. It's meant to traumatize and blind them, but us as well. It's meant to control us and make us fall in line and be good citizens. Let me see if I can find it. There's my biggest hero right now is an abolitionist named Ruth Wilson Gilmore. She's incredible. And she centers, I think, just the what I'm trying to say here so much. She says it so much better. So abolition is about abolishing the conditions under which prison became the solution to the problems rather than abolishing the buildings we call prisons. So I guess sending kids to prison isn't ever going to, it's just going to create more kids in prison. That's what it's meant to do.
Yeah, I mean, it keeps perpetuating a cycle of, oh, you made a mistake. There are going to be consequences. Now you have something on your record. Now you have a gap in your employment. And usually people like that, you know, the majority of them, you know, a big chunk of them, and so when they get out of these systems, right, their record is tarnished, You know, they don't have access to the same resources because they've been labeled a thief or an addict or violent.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
And it keeps perpetuating the cycle of poverty, you know, because what employer is going to hire somebody because we have this narrative of who's more deserving of a job, right? Or who's more deserving of a house or income.
Exactly. What land is going to house a criminal?
Yeah.
Quote unquote. It's like this. Yeah.
Very hard. And it's very, and they very don't. Hard. It's right. Very hard. It's very hard to, yeah.
Well, anyway. In some way, prison becomes the housing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's starting to get cold outside. I might as well just go to Fred Meyer and steal some shit and then get locked up where it's going to be warm and I'm not going to die. Because I know what happened to my friend last year when it got too cold. I was there, you know. I held them as they died kind of shit.
We have about 10 minutes before I have to get, before we have to wrap up. I was wondering in that 10 minutes, what kind of message or what kind of insights, what kinds of things do you want listeners to know in regards to what we've talked about today?
Whew. These are great. It's a great question. I guess what I really want people to leave here with is an understanding that education is needed. And I'm not saying in the school system, I'm saying our community needs to be educated on what our systems are actually participating in. We need to understand that the good we may want to bring about in the world is not being brought about into the world. And to bring about change, it's going to come through community restoration and just action on a small scale. I think the response to homelessness is not don't try to help someone find a job or put money in their cup as you pass by. Especially if your mindset's they're going to go spend it on drugs, you need to reflect. I would recommend that you go volunteer at one of the many really awesome Housing First communities that it's going on in Seattle, or just go to a soup kitchen if that's your thing. And like, but do it in a way where you're going to meet these people. And here's some stories. Yeah. I like, go meet your community members, I guess, because that's what this homeless population is. It's like our community members. So that's my biggest, I think, call to just the general public is like, A, go meet these people and listen to what they're saying and the stories they're telling. And then B, start asking yourself what your elected officials are doing and what support you're actually giving, because what we think is supportive is actually doing a lot more damage than any support system ever should be. Take a theater class, I guess. Like, outside of like, wake the fuck up.
Here's something I'll add to that is that, you know, the narrative that we have proposed on this community of human beings is inaccurate. And the systems in place and I would say a huge handful of nonprofits operate on the same narrative of shame and, you know, a very patriarchal, a very systemically rooted in, you know, our old Puritan ways of the Americas, right?
Yeah.
So that mindset of you do not have access to resources in our community and we will shun you. That, by far, I would say that mentality needs to shift.
Yeah.
So that being said, Is there anything that you want to leave us with?
Go look up Ruth Wilson Gilmore. Watch her videos online. She says some really awesome stuff that draws, I think, all of our attention to some really important issues. Read The Earth Path by Starhawk. Her work is phenomenal. Just start toying with what abolition means. I think what's exciting about it is it's not actually destruction or fire or us needing to wait for the zombie apocalypse. It's about creation and discovering the new systems that are gonna take the place of the old ones. I think so. I mean, I don't want to step on your toes or anything here, but I was reading about your proposal for voting and like the blockchain voting is abolition, like in such a cool and awesome way, because you're helping create something that restores the community's voice. And again, restoring community is the key here.
Yes.
Because you're...
See.
Yes, yes. Because it's not... Abolition is not about destroying democracy. It's about creating the democracy that's going to take the place of this failed democracy. Of this democracy that's not working.
This democracy that... democracy.
Right, you're right. We live in a billionaire's wet dream. Like this is
where they control the narrative.
You know, exactly the policies of how we interact in our communities, right?
To an extent that we probably don't even comprehend.
Yeah, I agree.
So that's I think that there is that's a call of its own, people. It's like create the shit that's gonna replace the stuff. Like what forms of oppression do you see in society that you think you might have some ability to like absolve? Or you know, you're not gonna dismantle this massive system we've built up, so we might as well start building the one that we want to take its place.
Yeah, free market, baby.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Liam, for being on our show. And to all of our listeners, I very much encourage you to visit my website. I have my website, how you can support my campaign, and all of my social media links. Yeah. I'd really like to promote how blockchain is going to revolutionize our current society and its structures and yes. hold people accountable. So I want to thank you once again for listening and have a great rest of your evening or have a great rest of your day.